Welcome to Stories from the Shadows, presenting haunted tales from the golden age of ghost stories and supernatural fiction. I'm Mardell, and this week's story is a ghastly gothic tale of a family curse, The Secret Chamber by Mrs. Oliphant. Castle Gowrie is one of the most famous and interesting in all Scotland. It is a beautiful old house to start with, perfect in the old feudal grandeur, with its clustered turrets and walls that could withstand an army, its labyrinths, its hidden stairs, its long mysterious passages, passages that seem in many cases to lead to nothing, but of which no one can be too sure what they lead to. The front, with its fine gateway and flanking towers, is approached now by velvet lawns and a peaceful, beautiful old avenue with double rows of trees like a cathedral, and the woods out of which these gray towers rise look as soft and rich in foliage, if not so lofty in growth, as the groves of the south. But this softness of aspect is all new to the place, that is, new within the century or two, which count for but little in the history of a dwelling place, some part of which at least has been standing since the days when the Saxon Athelings brought such share of the arts as belonged to them to solidify and regulate the original Celtic art, which reared incised stones upon rude burial places and twined mystic knots on its crosses before historic days. Even of this primitive decoration, there are relics at Gowrie, where the twistings and twinings of runic cords appear still on some bits of ancient wall, solid as rocks, and almost as everlasting. From these to the graceful French turrets, which recall many a gray chateau, what a long interval of years! But these are filled with stirring chronicles enough, besides the dim, not always decipherable records which different developments of architecture have left on the old house. The Earls of Gowrie had been in the heat of every commotion that took place on or about the Highland line for more generations than any but a Celtic pen could record. Rebellions, revenges, insurrections, conspiracies, nothing in which blood was shed and lands lost took place in Scotland in which they had not a share, and the annals of the house are very full, and not without many a stain. They had been a bold and vigorous race, with much evil in them, and some good, never insignificant, whatever else they might be. It could not be said, however, that they are remarkable nowadays. Since the first Stuart rising, known in Scotland as the 15, they have not done much that has been worth recording. But yet their family history has always been an unusual kind. The Randolphs could not be called eccentric in themselves. On the contrary, when you knew them, they were at bottom a respectable race, full of all the country gentlemen's virtues, and yet their public career, such as it was, had been marked by the strange leaps and jerks of vicissitude. You would have said an impulsive, fanciful family, now making a grasp at some visionary advantage, now rushing into some wild speculation, now making a sudden sally into public life, but soon falling back into mediocrity, not able apparently, even when the impulse was purely selfish and mercenary, to keep it up. But this would not have been at all a true conception of the family character. Their actual virtues were not of the imaginative order, and their freaks were a mystery to their friends. Nevertheless, these freaks were what the general world was most aware of in the Randolph race. The late Earl had been a representative peer of Scotland, they had no English title, and had made quite a wonderful start, and for a year or two had seemed about to attain a very eminent place in Scottish affairs. But his ambition was found to have been made use of some very equivocal modes of gaming influence, and he dropped accordingly at once and forever from the political firmament. This was quite a common circumstance in the family, an apparently brilliant beginning, a discovery of evil means adopted for ambitious ends, a sudden subsidence, and the curious conclusion at the end of everything that this schemer, this unscrupulous speculator or politician, was a dull, good man after all, an ambitious, contented, full of domestic kindness and benevolence. This family peculiarity made the history of the Randolphs a very strange one, broken by the oddest interruptions and with no consistency in it. There was another circumstance, however, which attracted still more the wonder and observation of the public. For one who can appreciate such a recondite matter as family character, there are hundreds who are interested in a family secret. And this the house of Randolph possessed in perfection. It was a mystery which piqued the imagination and excited the interest of the entire country. The story went that somewhere, hid amid the massive walls and tortuous passages, there was a secret chamber in Gowrie Castle. Everybody knew of its existence, but save the Earl, his heir, and one other person, not of the family, but filling a confidential post in their service, no mortal knew where this mysterious hiding place was. There had been countless guesses made at it, and expedients of all kinds invented to find it out. Every visitor who ever entered the old gateway, nay, even passing travelers who saw the turrets from the road, searched keenly for some trace of this mysterious chamber, but all guesses and researches were equally in vain. I was about to say that no ghost story I ever heard of has been so steadily and long believed, but this would be a mistake, for nobody knew even with any certainty that there was a ghost connected with it. A secret chamber was nothing wonderful in so old a house. No doubt they exist in many such old houses, and are always curious and interesting. Strange relics, more moving than any history, of the time when a man was not safe in his own house, and when it might be necessary to secure a refuge beyond the reach of spies or traitors at a moment's notice. Such a refuge was a necessity of life to a great medieval noble. The peculiarity about this secret chamber, however, was that some secret connected with the very existence of the family was always understood to be involved in it. It was not only the secret hiding place for an emergency, a kind of historical possession presupposing the importance of his race, of which a man might be honestly proud, but there was something hidden in it, of which assuredly the race could not be proud. It is wonderful how easily a family learns to pique itself upon any distinctive possession. A ghost is a sign of importance not to be despised. A haunted room is worth as much as a small farm to the complacency of the family that owns it. And no doubt the younger branches of the Gowrie family, the light-minded portion of the race, felt this, and were proud of their unfathomable secret, and felt a thrill of agreeable awe and piquant suggestion through them, when they remembered the mysterious something, which they did not know in their familiar home. That thrill ran through the entire circle of visitors and children and servants, when the Earl peremptorily forbade a projected improvement, or stopped a reckless exploration. They looked at each other with a pleasurable shiver. "Did you hear?" they said. "He will not let Lady Gowrie have that closet she wants so much in that bit of wall. He sent the workmen about their business before they could touch it, though the wall is 20 feet thick if it is an inch." "Ah," said the visitors, looking at each other, and this lively suggestion sent tinglings of excitement to their very finger points. But even to his wife, mourning the commodious closet she had intended, the Earl made no explanations. For anything she knew, it might be there next to her room, this mysterious lurking place, and it may be supposed that this suggestion conveyed to Lady Gowrie's veins a thrill more keen and strange, perhaps too vivid, to be pleasant. but she was not in the favored or unfortunate number of those to whom the truth could be revealed. I need not say what the different theories on the subject were. Some thought there had been a treacherous massacre there, and that the secret chamber was blocked by the skeletons of murdered guests. A treachery, no doubt, covering the family with shame in its day, but so condoned by a long softening of years as to have all the shame taken out of it. The Randolphs could not have felt their character affected by any such interesting historical record. They were not so morbidly sensitive. Some said, on the other hand, that Earl Robert, the wicked Earl, was shut up there in everlasting penance, playing cards with the devil for his soul, but it would have been too great a feather in the family cap to have thus got the devil, or even one of his angels, bottled up, as it were, and safely in hand, to make it possible that any lasting stigma could be connected with such a fact as this. What a thing it would be to know where to lay one's hand upon the Prince of Darkness, and prove him once for all cloven-foot in everything else, to the confusion of gainsayers. So this was not to be received as a satisfactory solution, nor could any other be suggested which was more to the purpose. The popular mind gave it up, and yet never gave it up. And still everybody who visits Gowrie, be it as a guest, be it as a tourist, be it only as a gazer from a passing carriage, or from the flying railway train, which just glimpses its turrets in the distance, daily and yearly spends a certain amount of curiosity, wonderment, and conjecture about the secret chamber, the most piquant and undiscoverable wonder which has endured unguessed and undeciphered to modern times. This was how the matter stood when young John Randolph, Lord Lindore, came of age. He was a young man of great character and energy, not like the usual Randolph strain, for, as we have said, the type of character common in this romantically situated family, notwithstanding the erratic incidents common to them, was that of dullness and honesty, especially in their early days. But young Lindore's was not so. He was honest and honorable, but not dull. He had gone through almost a remarkable course at school and at the university, not perhaps in quite the ordinary way of scholarship, but enough to attract men's eyes to him. He had made more than one great speech at the Union. He was full of ambition and force and life, intending all sorts of great things, and meaning to make his position a stepping stone to all that was excellent in public life. Not for him, the country gentleman existence, which was congenial to his father. The idea of succeeding to the family honors and becoming a Scotch peer, either represented or representative, filled him with horror, and filial piety in his case was made warm by all the energy of personal hopes when he prayed that his father might live, if not forever, yet longer than any Lord Gowrie had lived for the last century or two. He was as sure of his election for the county next time there was a chance as anybody can be certain of anything. And in the meantime, he meant to travel, go to America, to go no one could tell where, seeking for instruction and experience, as is the manner of high-spirited young men with parliamentary tendencies in the present day. In former times, he would have gone to the wars in Germany, or a crusade to the Holy Land, but the days of the crusaders and of the soldiers of fortune being over, Lindore's followed the fashion of his time. He had made all his arrangements for his tour, which his father did not oppose. On the contrary, Lord Gowrie encouraged all these plans, though with an air of melancholy indulgence, which his son could not understand. "It will do you good," he said with a sigh. "Yes, yes, my boy, the best thing for you." This no doubt was true enough, but there was an implied feeling that the young man would require something to do him good, that he would want the soothing of change and the gratification of his wishes, as one might speak of a convalescent or the victim of some calamity. This tone puzzled Lindores, who, though he thought it a fine thing to travel and acquire information, was as scornful of the idea of being done good to as is natural to any fine young fellow fresh from Oxford and the triumphs of the Union. But he reflected that the old school had its own way of treating things and was satisfied. All was settled accordingly for his journey. Before he came home to go through the ceremonial performances of the coming of age, the dinner of the tenantry, the speeches, the congratulations, his father's banquet, his mother's ball. It was in summer, and the country was as gay as all the entertainments that were to be given in his honor. His friend who was going to accompany him on his tour, as he had accompanied him through a considerable portion of his life, Almeric Farrington, a young man of the same aspirations, came up to Scotland with him for these festivities. As they rushed through the night on the Great Northern Railway, in the intervals of two naps, they had a scrap of conversation as to these birthday glories. "It will be a bore, but it will not last long," said Lindores. They were both of the opinion that anything that did not produce information or promote culture was a bore. "But is there not a revelation to be made to you among all the other things you have to go through?" said Farrington. "Have you not to be introduced to the secret chamber and all that sort of thing? I should like to be of the party there, Lindores." "Ah," said the heir, "I had forgotten that part of it," which, however, was not the case. "Indeed, I don't know if I am to be told. Even family dogmas are shaken nowadays." "Oh, I should insist on that," said Farrington lightly. "It is not many who have the chance of paying such a visit. Better than home and all the mediums, I should insist upon that." "I have no reason to suppose that it has any connection with home or the mediums," said Lindores, slightly nettled. He was himself an esprit. But a mystery of one's own family is not like vulgar mysteries. He liked it to be respected. "Oh, no offense," said his companion. "I have always thought that a railway train would be a great chance for the spirits. If one was to show suddenly in that vacant seat beside you, what a triumphant proof of their existence that would be. But they don't take advantage of their opportunities." Lindores could not tell what it was that made him think at that moment of a portrait he had seen in a back room of the castle of old Earl Robert, the wicked earl. It was a bad portrait, a daub, a copy made by an amateur of the genuine portrait, which, out of horror of Earl Robert and his wicked ways, had been removed by some intermediate lord from its place in the gallery. Lindores had never seen the original, nothing but this daub of a copy, yet somehow this face occurred to him by some strange link of association, seemed to come into his eyes as his friend spoke. A slight shiver ran over him. It was strange. He made no reply to Farrington, but he set himself to think how it could be that the latent presence in his mind of some anticipation of this approaching disclosure, touched into life by his friend's suggestion, should have called out of his memory a momentary realization of the acknowledged magician of the family. This sentence is full of long words, but unfortunately long words are required in such a case, and the process was very simple when you traced it out. It was the clearest case of unconscious cerebration. He shut his eyes by way of securing privacy while he thought it out, and being tired and not at all alarmed by his unconscious cerebration, before he opened them again, fell fast asleep. And his birthday, which was the day following his arrival at Glenyon, was a very busy day. He had not time to think of any but the immediate occupations of the moment. Public and private greetings, congratulations, offerings poured upon him. The Gowries were popular in this generation, which was far from being usual in the family. Lady Gowrie was kind and generous, with that kindness which comes from the heart, and which is the only kindness likely to impress the keen-sighted popular judgment. and Lord Gowrie had but little of the equivocal reputation of his predecessors. They could be splendid now and then on great occasions, though in general they were homely enough, all which the public likes. It was a bore, Lindor said, but yet the young man did not dislike the honors and the adulation and all the hearty speeches and good wishes. It is sweet to a young man to feel himself the center of all hopes. It seemed very reasonable to him, very natural, that he should be so, and that the farmer should feel a pride of anticipation in thinking of his future speeches in Parliament. He promised to them with the sincerest good faith that he would not disappoint their expectations, that he would feel their interest in him an additional spur. What so natural as that interest and these expectations? He was almost solemnized by his own position, so young, looked up to by so many people, so many hopes depending on him, and yet it was quite natural. His father, however, was still more solemnized than Lindor's, and this was strange, to say the least. His face grew graver and graver as the day went on, till almost it seemed as if he were dissatisfied with his son's popularity, or had some painful thought weighing on his mind. He was restless and eager for the termination of the dinner, and to get rid of his guests, and as soon as they were gone, showed an equal anxiety that his son should retire too. "Go to bed at once as a favor to me," Lord Gowrie said. "You will have a great deal of fatigue tomorrow." "You need not be afraid for me, sir," said Lindor's half affronted, but he obeyed, being tired. He had not once thought of the secret to be disclosed to him through all that long day. But when he woke suddenly with a start in the middle of the night to find the candles all lighted in his room and his father standing by his bedside, Lindor's instantly thought of it, and in a moment felt that the leading event, the chief incident of all that had happened, was going to take place now. Lord Gowrie was very grave and very pale. He was standing with his hand on his son's shoulder to wake him. His dress was unchanged from the moment they had parted, and the sight of this formal costume was very bewildering to the young man as he started up in his bed. But next moment he seemed to know exactly how it was, and more than that, to have known it all his life. Explanation seemed unnecessary. At any other moment, in any other place, a man would be startled to be suddenly woken up in the middle of the night. But Lindor's had no such feeling. He did not even ask a question, but sprang up and fixed his eyes, taking in all the strange circumstances on his father's face. "Get up, my boy," said Lord Gowrie, "and dress as quickly as you can. It is full time. I have lighted your candles, and your things are all ready. You have had a good long sleep." Even now he did not ask, "What is it?" as under any other circumstances he would have done. He got up without a word, with an impulse of nervous speed and rapidity of movement, such as only excitement can give, and dressed himself, his father helping him silently. It was a curious scene, the room gleaming with lights, the silence, the hurried toilet, the stillness of deep night all around. The house, though so full, and with the echoes of festivity but just over, was quiet as if there was not a creature within it. More quiet indeed, for the stillness of vacancy is not half so impressive as the stillness of hushed and slumbering life. Lord Gowrie went to the table when this first step was over, and poured out a glass of wine from a bottle which stood there, a rich, golden-colored, perfumey wine, which sent its scent through the room. "You will want all your strength," he said. "Take this before you go. It is the famous imperial Tokay. There's only a little left. And you will want all your strength." Lindors took the wine. He had never drunk any like it before, and the peculiar fragrance remained in his mind, as perfumes so often do, with a whole world of association in them. His father's eyes dwelt upon him with a melancholy sympathy. "You are going to encounter the greatest trial of your life," he said, and taking the young man's hand into his, felt his pulse. "It is quick, but it is quite firm, and you have had a good long sleep." Then he did what it needs a great deal of pressure to induce an Englishman to do. He kissed his son on the cheek. "God bless you," he said, faltering. "Come now, everything is ready, Lindors." He took up in his hand a small lamp, which he had apparently brought with him, and led the way. By this time, Lindors began to feel himself again and to wake to the consciousness of all his own superiorities and enlightenments. The simple sense that he was one of the members of a family with a mystery, and that the moment of his personal encounter with this special power of darkness had come, had been the first thrilling, overwhelming thought. But now, as he followed his father, Lindors began to remember that he himself was not altogether like other men, that there was that in him which would make it natural, that he should throw some light, hitherto unthought, upon this carefully preserved darkness. What secret even there might be in it, secret of hereditary tendency, of psychic force, of mental conformation, or of some curious combination of circumstances, at once more and less potent than these, it was for him to find out. He gathered all his forces about him, reminded himself of modern enlightenment, and bade his nerves to be steel to all vulgar horrors. He too felt his own pulse as he followed his father, to spend the night perhaps amongst the skeletons of that old-world massacre, and to repent the sins of his ancestors, to be brought within the range of some optical illusion believed in hitherto by all the generations, and which no doubt was of a startling kind, or his father would not look so serious. Any of these he felt himself quite strong to encounter. His heart and spirit rose. A young man has but seldom the opportunity of distinguishing himself so early in his career, and his was such a chance as occurs to very few. No doubt it was something that would be extremely trying to the nerves and imagination. He called up all his powers to vanquish both. And along with this call upon himself to exertion, there was the less serious impulse of curiosity. He would see at last what the secret chamber was, where it was, how it fitted into the labyrinths of the old house. This he tried to put in its due place as a most interesting object. He said to himself that he would willingly have gone a long journey at any time to be present at such an exploration, and there is no doubt that in other circumstances a secret chamber with probably some unthought-of historical interest in it would have been a very fascinating discovery. He tried very hard to excite himself about this, but it was curious how fictitious he felt the interest, and how conscious he was that it was an effort to feel any curiosity at all on the subject. The fact was that the secret chamber was entirely secondary, thrown back as all accessories are by a more pressing interest. The overpowering thought of what was in it drove aside all healthy, natural curiosity about itself. It must not be supposed, however, that the father and son had a long way to go to have time for all these thoughts. Thoughts travel at lightning speed, and there was abundant leisure for this between the time they had left the door of Lindor's room and gone down the corridor, no further off than to Lord Gowrie's own chamber, naturally one of the chief rooms of the house. Nearly opposite this, a few steps further on, was a little neglected room devoted to lumber. with which Lindores had been familiar all his life. Why, this nest of old rubbish, dust, and cobwebs should be so near the bedroom of the head of the house had been a matter of surprise to many people, to the guests who saw it while exploring, and to each new servant in succession who planned an attack upon its ancient stores, scandalized by finding it to have been neglected by their predecessors. All their attempts to clear it out had, however, been resisted. Nobody could tell how, or indeed thought it worthwhile to inquire. As for Lindores, he had been used to the place from his childhood and therefore accepted it as the most natural thing in the world. He had been in and out of it 100 times in his play. And it was here, he remembered suddenly, that he had seen the bad picture of Earl Robert, which had so curiously come into his eyes on his journeying here by a mental movement which he had identified at once as unconscious cerebration. The first feeling in his mind as his father went to the open door of this lumber room was a mixture of amusement and surprise. What was he going to pick up there? Some old pentacle, some amulet or scrap of antiquated magic to act as armor against the evil one? But Lord Gowrie, going on and setting down the lamp on the table, turned round upon his son with a face of agitation and pain, which barred all further amusement. He grasped him by the hand, crushing it between his own. "Now, my boy, my dear son," he said in tones that were scarcely audible. His countenance was full of the dreary pain of a looker on, one who has no share in the excitement of personal danger, but has the more terrible part of watching those who are in deadliest peril. He was a powerful man, and his large form shook with emotion. Great beads of moisture stood upon his forehead. An old sword with a cross handle lay upon a dusty chair, among other dusty and battered relics. "Take this with you," he said in the same inaudible, breathless way. Whether as a weapon, whether as a religious symbol, Lindores could not guess. The young man took it mechanically. His father pushed open a door which seemed to him he had never seen before, and led him into another vaulted chamber. Here even the limited powers of speech Lord Gowrie had retained seemed to forsake him, and his voice became a mere hoarse murmur in his throat. For want of speech, he pointed to another door in the further corner of this small vacant room, and gave him to understand by a gesture that he was to knock there, and then went back into the lumber room. The door into this was left open, and a faint glimmer of the lamp shed light into this little intermediate place, this debatable land between the seen and the unseen. In spite of himself, Lindor's heart began to beat. He made a breathless pause, feeling his head go round. He held the old sword in his hand, not knowing what it was. Then, summoning all his courage, he went forward and knocked at the closed door. His knock was not loud, but it seemed to echo all over the silent house. Would everybody hear and wake and rush to see what had happened? This caprice of imagination seized upon him, ousting all the firmer thoughts, the steadfast calm of mind with which he sought to have encountered the mystery. Would they all rush in and wide deshabille, in terror and dismay, before the door opened? How long it was of opening! He touched the panel with his hand again. This time there was no delay. In a moment, as if thrown suddenly open by someone within, the door moved. It opened just wide enough to let him enter, stopping halfway, as if someone invisible held it wide enough for a welcome, but no more. Lindor stepped across the threshold with a beating heart. What was he about to see? The skeletons of the murdered victims? a ghostly charnel house full of bloody traces of crime. He seemed to be hurried and pushed in as he made that step. What was this world of mystery into which he was plunged? What was it he saw? He saw nothing, except what was agreeable enough to behold. An antiquated room hung with tapestry, very old tapestry of rude design, its colors faded into softness and harmony, between its folds here and there a panel of carved wood, rude too in design, with traces of half-worn gilding, a table covered with strange instruments, parchments, chemical tubes, and curious machinery, all with a quaintness of form and dimness of material that bespoke of age. A heavy old velvet cover, thick with embroidery, faded almost out of all color, was on the table. On the wall above it, something that looked like a very old Venetian mirror, the glass so dim and crusted that it scarcely reflected at all. On the floor, an old, soft Persian carpet, worn into a vague blending of all colors. This was all that he thought he saw. His heart, which had been thumping so loud as almost to choke him, stopped that tremendous upward and downward motion like a steam piston, and he grew calm. Perfectly still, dim, unoccupied, yet not so dim either. There was no apparent source of light, no windows, curtains of tapestry drawn everywhere, no lamp visible, no fire. And yet a kind of strange light, which made everything quite clear. He looked around, trying to smile at his terrors, trying to say to himself that it was the most curious place he had ever seen, that he must show Farrington some of that tapestry, that he really must bring away a panel of that carving, when he suddenly saw that the door was shut by which he had entered. Nay, more than shut, undiscernible, covered like all the rest of the walls by that strange tapestry. At this his heart began to beat again in spite of him. He looked round once more, and woke up to more vivid being with a sudden start. Had his eyes been incapable of vision on his first entrance, unoccupied, who was that in the great chair? It seemed to Lindors that he had seen neither the chair nor the man when he came in. There they were, however, solid and unmistakable, the chair carved like the panels, the man seated in front of the table. He looked at Lindors with a calm and open gaze, inspecting him. The young man's heart seemed in his throat, fluttering like a bird, but he was brave, and his mind made one final effort to break the spell. He tried to speak, laboring with a voice that would not sound, and with lips too parched to form a word. "I see how it is," was what he wanted to say. It was Earl Robert's face that was looking at him, and startled as he was, he dragged forth his philosophy to support him. What could it be but optical delusions, unconscious cerebration, occult seizure by the impressed and struggling mind of this one countenance? But he could not hear himself speak any word as he stood convulsed, struggling with dry lips and choking voice. The appearance smiled, as if knowing his thoughts, not unkindly, not malignly, with a certain amusement mingled with scorn. Then he spoke, and the sound seemed to breathe through the room, not like any voice that Lindors had ever heard, a kind of utterance of the place, like the rustle of the air or the ripple of the sea. "You will learn better tonight. This is no phantom of your brain. It is I." "In God's name," cried the young man in his soul. He did not know whether the words ever got into the air or not, if there was any air. "In God's name, who are you?" The figure rose as if coming to him to reply, and Lindor's, overcome by the apparent approach, struggled into utterance. A cry came from him. He heard it this time, and even in his extremity, felt a pang the more to hear the terror in his own voice. But he did not flinch. He stood desperate, all his strength concentrated in the act. He neither turned nor recoiled. Vaguely gleaming through his mind came the thought that to be thus brought in contact with the unseen was the experiment to be most desired on earth, the final settlement of 100 questions, but his faculties were not sufficiently under command to entertain it. He only stood firm. That was all. And the figure did not approach him. After a moment, it subsided back again into the chair. Subsided, for no sound, not the faintest, accompanied its movements. It was the form of a man of middle age, the hair white, but the beard only crisped with gray. The features, those of the picture, a familiar face, more or less like all the Randolphs, but with an air of domination and power, altogether unlike that of the race. He was dressed in a long robe of dark color, embroidered with strange lines and angles. There was nothing repellent or terrible in his air, nothing except the noiselessness, the calm, the absolute stillness, which was as much in the place as in him, to keep up the involuntary trembling of the beholder. His expression was full of dignity and thoughtfulness, and not malignant or unkind. He might have been the kindly patriarch of the house, watching over its fortunes in a seclusion that he had chosen. The pulses that had been beating in Lindor's were stilled. What was his panic for? A gleam even of self-ridicule took possession of him, to be standing there like an absurd hero of an antiquated romance with a rusty, dusty sword. Good for nothing, surely not adapted for use against this noble old magician. In his hand? "You are right," said the voice, once more answering his thoughts. "What could you do with that sword against me, young Lindors? Put it by. Why should my children meet me like an enemy? You are my flesh and blood. Give me your hand." A shiver ran through the young man's frame. The hand that was held out to him was large and shapely and white, with a straight line across the palm, a family token upon which the Randolphs prided themselves. A friendly hand, and the face smiled upon him, fixing him with those calm, profound blue eyes. "Come," said the voice. The words seemed to fill the place, melting upon him from every corner, whispering round him with softest persuasion. He was lulled and calmed in spite of himself. Spirit or no spirit, why should he not accept this proffered courtesy? What harm could come of it? The chief thing that retained him was the dragging of the old sword, heavy and useless, which he held mechanically, but which some internal feeling, he could not tell what, prevented him from putting down. Superstition, was it? "Yes, that is superstition," said his ancestor serenely. "Put it down and come." "You know my thoughts," said Lindors. "I did not speak." "Your mind spoke, and justly. Put down that emblem of brute force and superstition together. Here, it is the intelligence that is supreme. Come." Lindor stood, doubtful. He was calm. The power of thought was restored to him. If this benevolent, venerable patriarch was all he seemed, why his father's terror? Why the secrecy in which his being was involved? His own mind, though calm, did not seem to act in the usual way. Thought seemed to be driven across it as by a wind. One of these came to him suddenly now. How there looked him in the face an angel, beautiful and bright, and how he knew it was a fiend. To be continued. Join me next week on Stories from the Shadows for the finale of The Secret Chamber by Mrs. Oliphant.